Welcome to Hot Yoga Radio this fine day in January 2018. Today I'd like to talk about music. It will be like most of the things that I do, a prolegomena to some more detailed considerations in the future. So I expect there'll be a music part two, music part three perhaps. And towards that end, I want to do some research or revisit some research I've done in the past about what philosophers think music is, what they think about the way it works, and what its significance might be for human life. There's quite a range of philosophers have thought about music. And in the 20th century, there was certainly quite a bit of research amongst aestheticians and attempts to get to grips with it. And in the 19th century, Schopenhauer and Nietzsche had a big concern for music. So what is music? And there's a number of ways of proceeding with that question. We can be sort of kind of dry and quasi-scientific and say something like, well, music is organised sound. That's done for reasons of expression and art and pleasure and for arousing moods in audiences and so forth. You have that kind of approach. Or you could be like the Sufi Inayat Khan, who said, music is nothing other than the portrait of our beloved. More poetic approach to the question. And of course Nietzsche's adage that life without music would be a mistake. And more broadly, that life is only rendered tolerable by art. Art's job is to render life tolerable in the face of its tragic character. Schopenhauer, who I mentioned earlier, had a kind of a similar view that music was the one saving grace against the blind chaos of the will, which is the deep nature of reality. And I'll go into that sometime in the future. So let's just dive into that Sufi characterisation of music. Music is nothing other than the portrait of our beloved. And what's going on here is that music is seen as representing the beloved. And for a theist, that would be God. And obviously this is a kind of a mysticism in which music arouses the mystical feelings to the extent that one feels at least able to look, if not directly on the beloved, but on a portrait of the beloved. So music forms a connection between the individual and the ultimate. Now that might be God, and for Sufis, you know, have this sort of devotional tendency that would describe where they're coming from. But this could work equally well in a non-theist context, in which it would be love itself. Love itself would be that which music portrays for us. So there's a sense of elevated emotion associated with experiencing music. And here we can utilise our scientific definition and talk about elevated emotion of a devotional kind being aroused by organised sound for purposes of mysticism, a mystical contemplation. And this isn't so far away from either Schopenhauer or Nietzsche, even though because we're going to get differences in detail and so forth. And certainly, music can arouse a variety of emotions, and both the ancient Greek modal system and the raga system of India takes this view, and even takes the view that specific modes or specific sets of notes, specific intervals, have got specific emotional climates attached to them, and the ability to arouse specific emotional states. And certainly some of the modes, I'm thinking in the Greek system, for instance, you know, they're associated with a warlike emotion, hence the use of drums and skirling pipes in battle, and to arouse troops into a state of bravery and berserkness just prior to battle. Others are associated with erotic arousal and lovemaking. Some of this have a very lofty devotion to objects of veneration or gods. There are ragas in the Indian system devoted to Bhairava, who is the destructive aspect of Shiva, and which are played in the early morning at dawn as the sunlight destroys the darkness and as night is destroyed by the opening up of the day. And raga is devoted to Bhairavi, the female consort of Bhairava, which obviously has a slightly different character, and so on. And the raga system is associated with a tradition of what is known as ragamala, and these are paintings, small miniatures, usually figurative paintings, which are meant to capture in visual terms the mood of the raga. And for instance, there's one little painting which depicts, I think this is Bhairavi, and it depicts a female ascetic worshipping a Shiva lingam, and so forth. So this is a further development of the idea of a raga or a mode capturing an emotional climate, arousing a certain emotional state in listeners and players, of course. Into the visual field to further elucidate the emotional climate of the raga. Now, this is very interesting, of course, and is it true? Does it actually work? And I think we have to be a bit careful here, because the way all this is understood, and certainly the way it's understood in Schopenhauer as well, is that the responses are universal. That, in other words, they have no cultural specificity attached to them. And that benefit will arouse that particular emotion in anybody, wherever they come from. And I think the same idea applies with the Greek modes, and it's an idea deriving from Pythagoreanism. Since music does have mathematical descriptions, since music can be analysed in terms of numbers and mathematics in general. And what makes me want to question that a little bit is recalling a remark made by Alan Watts about a time that he spent with a Japanese shakuhachi player, and the guy would play a melody and say to Alan Watts, what do you think the mood of that is? And I think Alan Watts on a couple of occasions said, oh, that particular set of notes, it's quite melancholy. It's about sadness and perhaps grief. And the guy said, well, for us, it's very happy. And I think that kind of pretty well shows that there's some cultural specificity going on there. And of course, our responses to music, for most people, are going to be sort of built up from an early age through hearing music appropriate to one's culture and going through an education system, which in most cases does bring about some familiarity with music. I mean, if not through the singing of hymns and chanting of slogans, maybe in some regimes, and so forth. So I think there is a kind of bit of cultural specificity operating here. Even though I'm also wanting to account for the fact that, well, vibrations of atoms in the air, striking the ear, striking the body, cause physiological, material responses in the body. And as I said, you know, this is utilised in a certain kind of music for arousing warlike emotions and preparing for battle. So it seems, because we've got this physiological level, that we could argue from that towards some sort of universalism of response, that certain frequencies, certain notes, certain melodies, certain rhythms will almost universally produce quite a definite emotional coloration of the consciousness of those hearing the music. And I think really we've got both things going on here. You know, given that we are dealing with physiology, material vibration, that's actually on the level of atoms and molecules rather than fluctuations in electrical and magnetic fields, as in the case of light and X-rays and electromagnetic vibration. Musical vibration is actually like that. Yeah, it's at this sort of a level of atoms, molecules, objects. And musical vibration, of course, is carried through the air, or it can be carried through water or through solids and so on. And it's happening at the same level of scale as our physiology, as human beings, as animals. So you have to account for that. And that does give a degree of universalism, but over which is overlaid culture and what you've learned, what you've been acquainted with as a child. If music grabs you, you very often want to listen to music from other cultures, especially in the modern age, where the, a lot of it's available to us. And one can learn, and one can develop and refine one's responses. So we have a kind of an overlay of learning and of culture, built upon a substrate of the physiological and the material. So, music is nothing other than the portrait of our beloved. Now, obviously, Inniat Cain is talking about the music that he, in fact, himself played. He was an accomplished musician. I think he was a veena player, I think. And so, his concern was to arouse those particular emotions that are to do with devotion and to do with love. And I can't imagine playing a battlefield music on a veena, to be honest. It's a delicate instrument and very, very well suited to the expression of devotion. And as I said, and that doesn't need to be theistic, it could be non-theistic. But the crucial element there is the emotion of love. Now, everything I've said so far is about the reception of music. It's all coming down on the side of the listener, explaining how it works on audiences or listeners. But, of course, there's the other side, which is the production of music. Now, the style of music produced by somebody like Inniat Cain and other musicians who have this mystical approach to music and devotional approach to music is a modal music. It utilises the raga system, which is a modal system of northern India. Now, there's also a rhythmic system associated with that called tala, and again with a similar understanding of rhythmic patterns and their relations to certain styles of emotion. And what we should say about this music is that it's improvised. Now, the player knows the notes that he's going to use, and the note set may have an ascending pattern and a slightly different descending pattern, or ascent and descent may be the same, and there may be some little melodic turns that are characteristic of a particular raga or mode. And these are time honoured. Some of them have been around a very long time. And a musical system is laid out in the Samaveda, so you go way, way back. But they do change slowly. I mean, this is a conservative school of music. One doesn't change things without inviting criticism, I think. You know, it's conservative. There is a strong sense of preserving something that's been discovered. But at the same time, they do change over time. We know what certain versions of certain ragas were in the 17th century, and how they fell out of fashion and came back with a slight modification. And now in modern times, some players have move them around a little bit, or mix them with other modes. But basically, you're plugging into something that's seen as a time-honoured understanding of the human emotional system and the notes of music and the emotional climate associated with certain sets of notes and certain ways of playing those sets of notes. But on the top of that, there's this improvisational approach in which, within the note system and the rules for combining the notes, that the player has got a great deal of freedom. And in fact, the player is meant to really enter into a meditative and devotional state. So, and have such mastery of his or her instrument or voice, the human voice of course is included, that the relevant emotion can express itself directly. And of course the player is meant to have such technical facility that that doesn't intrude. There's almost a direct channel from the portrait of the beloved, and through that from the beloved, his or herself through, and for that to come out as the music, as an expression. But it's not like a personal expression that you might get with the singer-songwriter tradition of the 20th century pop stroke folk music, you know, where you sing about your hang-ups. It's about this rather more universal emotion, particularly in the case of the Sufi musicians. The emotion, the devotional emotion, or the emotion of very, very great love. But of course, it's personal to the extent that the actual player has to be very, very well acquainted with it. And in a sense, has at best to be in that emotional condition and expressing that emotional condition at the time of performance. And where the improvisation comes in is that, of course, it makes all this very real, very authentic and very direct. It's actual real emotion that is being expressed, rather than the going through the motions. And so this is quite a contrast from sitting down at the piano and opening out the score and playing the Schubert song or whatever it might be that expresses the emotions that he might have felt 100 years ago, 150 years ago, whatever it was, and acting as an interpreter of that, and actually in a sense almost being a bit like a device for playing a recording. Now this improvised music of devotion isn't like that. You're not reinterpreting somebody else's feelings. And you're not acting like a recording device in playback mode. Or at least only to the extent that you draw on the tradition and the traditional understanding of the mode, which you will have got from your teacher. So this is a pretty different kind of state of affairs, and I think it points out that music's got a lot of ways of operating, as well as having huge range culturally, and a huge number of uses, you might say. Now the relationship of music, of the type we've been mostly discussing here, of devotional music, or music of love, to systems of contemplative practice, or to varieties of mysticism, it's not really a simple one. It's one that's historically been imbued with tension. And I suppose, putting it very roughly, you get a puritanical take on this, that any kind of emotional arousal is bad, and that music makes kind of automata of people, and until you can get a kind of a pure, yeah, a sort of puritanical backlash. And as we know, there's a strong strain of asceticism in many contemplative approaches, and in fact many of the great religions. And there's a sort of a down on anything to do with the enjoyment of the senses, or the intoxication that can come through the stimulation of the senses, particularly through music. There's been a lack of control, lack of discipline, and there's been too pleasure orientated. There's ascetic puritanism, in which the idea is that contemplation is to overcome, is to control, is to produce will. And music of the type that we've been discussing, love music, goes the other way. It's tantric, you know. And I think what we're getting in is the, in the specific sphere of musical art, the same dichotomy that you get between life-affirmative contemplative practices and life-negating contemplative practices, and between attitudes that celebrate the senses and pleasure and eroticism, even, on the one hand, and those which deny and see denial as the method on the other hand. And you should be aware of that. I mean, there are Sufi schools for which music is everything. It's the whole vehicle. Music is nothing other than the portrait of our beloved. And then Sufi schools that just could prescribe music. Just said, just don't go there, it's too intoxicating, it's too dangerous, it's too imprecise. It's too much to do with pleasure and the senses. I'm sure you can guess where I come down on that dichotomy. I do like to play music, particularly to improvise. This is a kind of letting it happen, letting the music happen, letting it come out. Now, I suppose for some people it's a sort of degenerate noodling. But I have to say, it's great to do. Anyway, I am going to carry on doing some research into what philosophers have said about these issues. And this is a case of revisiting some stuff that I looked into years and years ago, decades ago, in fact. And I'm hoping that out of that I'll be able to come back with some episode 2 and episode 3 on this very interesting theme of music. Okay, friends. Thanks for listening.